This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. Before I get into my first story, if you've been listening to your local ABC radio today, you'd know it's ABC Gives Giveathon. So today we're raising money for Oz Harvest to keep their wheels turning and to help people struggling to put food on the table. So Oz Harvest rescues surplus food and delivers it to charities that feed people in need. This year, food insecurity in Australia has reached a critical point. And the charities Oz Harvest support reported a 73% increase in demand in the last 6 months. 46% of those charities cannot meet the current demand. So today, every dollar donated delivers two meals to someone in need, and every little bit counts. If you'd like to make a donation, you can head online to the abc.net.au/QLDGives. That's abc.net.au/QLDGives. If you'd like to make a donation over the phone, you can call 3708 1388. That's 3708 1388. I'll get into today's show now. To some breaking news, the Liberal Shadow Ministry has agreed to dump net zero by 2050 from the party's platform. The group agreed to scrap net zero from the Climate Change Act and repeal Labor's 2030 emissions reduction target. This comes after months of infighting over the climate policy. And I'll bring you more on this story as it comes to light. Now, Australia's farm chemical regulator this week suspended the use of a popular insecticide over several types of berries after rising consumption levels reduced safety margins. Berries Australia has said this week that losing that chemical could drive up the cost of berries. And now the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority has spoken about their decision to halt the use of dimethylate, which is the chemical used to control fruit fly on blueberries, raspberries and blackberries. APVMA Chief Executive Scott Hansen says the move has rebuilt the safety buffer and Australians can continue to enjoy their berries safely.
Data that we were provided with in February this year demonstrated a significant change in the consumption patterns for blueberries, blackberries and raspberries over the last 10 years since the last time we did these calculations for products that are used on those foods. Mm. When we had a look at the increases, it triggered us to do a proactive review of all chemical products that are used on those food crops to work out if we put that calculation of that many times a person is consuming it into our calculators, did we still have a safety margin between levels of exposure and risk levels? And for blueberries, blackberries and raspberries with the chemical dimethylate, we had significantly eaten into that safety buffer and we therefore had to take actions to adjust something on the way in which the product was being used to be able to reinsert a safety margin between exposure levels and what's a risk to a consumer.
So this decision, does it mean that growers basically cannot use dimethylate on blueberries, raspberries and blackberries from now on?
Yeah, so our decision to suspend the 11 products, dimethylate products that are used on berries, means that it's illegal to use those products in accordance with what's on their labels at the moment. What's on the labels at the moment says there's a one-day withholding period, for example, for blueberries, between when the product is applied to the blueberries to the time in which the blueberries are harvested. Now, that use pattern, the ability to do that is suspended. And what we have done is issued a permit that allows for those suspended products to still be able to be used for all the remaining uses that are on their labels, because there's a wide range of crops that are still well within safety levels on those products' labels. and allows for it to still be used for blackberries, blueberries and raspberries, but with a withholding period or a period between when it's treated and when it can be harvested of now 14 days, because the science and the data shows us that at the 14-day mark post-treatment, we have that lower level of remaining residues. The current consumption patterns pose no risk to consumers.
The peak body, Berries Australia, says it accepts the APVMA's decision, but they say that the 14-day withholding period is unworkable just due to berries being picked so often, you know, 2 to 3 days. So essentially this takes it off the table for the majority of growers. What are your thoughts on that?
So we have a very clear mandate that our responsibility is ensuring that the product remains safe to for both consumers, for workers, for the environment, and for our trade. And in running our statutory test, you know, we don't look at and don't take into account any inconvenience or disruption to production systems. And it's not one of the things that we can take into account when we're running those statutory tests as to whether we can approve a product. You know, first and foremost for us is the protection and the safety and health of people and the environment, animals and our trade.
You received 22 submissions. I suppose the data that was put forward by some of those 22 submitters wasn't strong enough to change your decision?
That's right, Brandon. Every one of those submissions was considered. We've been publishing our response, summary of those submissions and our response to those submissions, so people can see how we've dealt with or how we've considered any information or data that they have provided to us. Many of the submissions pointed to issues such as the increased difficulty for production systems or increased costs in managing biosecurity risks in the absence of the current products. But again, they weren't things that we're able to take into account. There was new data provided around some potential changes to what the acute reference dose for health impacts are. And we reviewed that, and we reviewed that against international literature and international standards, and we've been able to reinforce the decision that we proposed back in August, which was the suspension of all products and the deeming of a permit to move the withholding period for berries out to 14 days post-treatment. And we'll now wait to see whether the registrants of those 11 products seek to, within the one-year period we've given, to either vary their labels, to change labels to reflect that 14-day withholding period, whether they want to remove berries off the label altogether. And either of those two things would move those products out of the suspended list and allow them to continue to be used as a registered product.
Berries safe for people to consume?
Definitely. The work that we have done indicated that with a significant increase in consumption of berries, we had eaten into the safety margin that had been built in to previous approvals, but we hadn't triggered or gone over the edge of that safety parameter. And so what we've done by changing the withholding period here from 1 day to 14 day is rebuild that safety buffer, which means that berries continue to be safe to eat.
APVMA Chief Executive Scott Hansen speaking to Brandon Long. It is 14 minutes past 12. Up next, how climate-proof are solar panels and do standards need to change?
ABC Breakfast. There's never been a better way to start your day. We're local like you, and we'll be right here every weekday when the sun rises. Join us for breakfast, weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Giant hailstones laid waste to solar panels in two supercell storms that hit southeast Queensland earlier this month. Almost 2 weeks after that event, with residents still picking up the pieces, it's had people asking, with more hailstorms on the horizon, exactly how climate-proof are solar panels? Grace Nakamura has this story.
Prue and Jamie Rogers moved from Brisbane to a rural property on Queensland's Darling Downs last year to live the quiet life.
You know, we wanted to be out here to be off-grid, not have to have worry about bills and just to live our life the best we could without forking out money all the time.
But Mother Nature had other plans.
Literally the worst experience ever in my life. I have never seen hail so bad. Come back out to put towels over the car, as that's what you would do if you have hail, not expecting it to be the size that it was. And then I got bombarded with the hail on my back, on my head, and had to hide under the house until I could make refuge back into the inside. It was scary. It was very scary.
The Rogers rely entirely on their 21 solar panels to power their property, and the hail smashed every last panel. The damage to their place was immense.
Five cars are damaged, mainly glass and panel damage, tractor, fuel pods.
Solar.
Solar's completely gone. Yeah, and whatever damage is to the roof.
And that's what I've heard around Pratton, is the fact that there is a lot that don't have insurance on their properties, which is very sad. We're one of them. It costs so much for insurance that you can't even insure your place to for these type of things.
Since those two destructive storms in early November, there have been 28,250 insurance claims lodged about the severe weather event in southeast Queensland. There's no breakdown on the number of claims that relate to solar panel damage, and there are more storms on the horizon.
So our general expectation is that over time, as the atmosphere gets warmer, we might get thunderstorms that are capable of producing larger hailstones.
Dr. Tim Rawpak is from the University of New South Wales Institute for Climate Risk and Response. He co-authored research this year that looked at how hail damage potential in major Australian cities might change in the future.
So in this work, we were using computer simulations over cities across Australia and the areas around them to try to see how many hail storms we got and any changes to the hailstone sizes and winds around the hail in the future scenarios that we were running. And what we found was that in some cities, such as Sydney, Canberra and Melbourne, we did see really significant increases in the future simulated hailstone sizes. And in other places, like around Brisbane, we actually saw an increase in frequency in the hailstorms in the projected future, but not a significant change in the hailstone sizes.
But Dr. Rawpak says it's still possible for regions around Brisbane to experience large hail, like the 9-centimetre hail that fell in the Darling Downs on November 1st.
And we do also know that hail can really grow to those kind of extreme sizes. So anything above 5 centimetres in Australia, we call that giant hail. And yeah, 9-centimetre hail is really getting into some of the extreme sizes.
This modelling is based on global warming of 2.4 degrees, which experts say could happen by the end of this century. But Dr. Rawpak is an optimist.
You know, I like to remember that we are still in the driver's seat, really, when it comes to how much temperature change we produce in the world and with global warming, because we have the power to still change and reduce our emissions that really are the big control on that temperature change.
Right now, there are more than 4 million households and businesses in Australia with rooftop solar. That's millions of solar panels taking the brunt of the giant hail that's expected to keep falling in Australia. So, is it time to change the national standard for solar panels? Adam Stingmore is the Chief Development Officer with Standards Australia, the body that adopts and develops the standards for almost all products in the country.
A solar panel on a roof, of course, has to deal with all sorts of weather, sun, wind, hail, rain, and they're made to standards that give them a design life in most part of between 20 and 25 years. So the international standard that we've adopted here in Australia says that for a minimum compliant product, it must withstand a 25 millimetre hailstone coming at a velocity that would match that of a hailstorm. The standard also allows for testing up to 75 millimetres for different sizes of hail. And there's a lot of products now coming onto the market that go above the minimum standard and provide more hail protection.
Changing the standards is a discussion to be had between governments, community, industry and Standards Australia, but it can be done.
This is quite common in the standard setting process, that as conditions change, the standards change to meet those different conditions. So it's happened in cyclones, it's happened in storm surge, and standards revisions generally run between 3 and 5 years at the international level and very much based on data. So if the standards for solar panels are continuing to evolve for three things: first of all, safety, second of all, efficiency, and third of all, to make sure that they meet the requirements of the environments which are installed.
Back in Pratton, the Rogers have been able to negotiate a payment plan with their solar company to put new panels on their roof.
Luckily for us, we were able to negotiate with our solar company that we have from Toowoomba and get on a payment plan and be able to get new solar installed. Otherwise, we would have had to have waited till May next year. That's how far they're booked out till, because we're off grid, so we would have had no power whatsoever till May next year.
While the storm has passed, for now they'll be keeping one eye on the sky.
The whole reason we moved out here was to live a life of peace, which is funny because we haven't had it since we've been here.
That story from Grace Nakamura.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
So United States meat processing and trading company Cargill has last week upped its stakes from 50% to full ownership of Australia's second largest beef packer, Tees. So Tees' headquarters is at 8 Mile Plains in Brisbane, and the company employs more than 4,800 staff across 14 sites in four states. Sean Layton is the Global Senior Vice President of Food Safety, Quality and Regulatory Affairs for Cargill. And while he didn't disclose the sale price, he tells Jennifer Nichols the aim is to grow the business.
We've been in partnership with Tees Beef for, I think, over 15 years now. Joint venture partnership, hand-in-hand with Tees, to produce high-quality, safe beef throughout Australia and beyond. And just this week, we closed a deal to take on full ownership of the Tees operation. Cargill, I think, is keen on growing in the Australia region, and so, you know, acquiring it fully is a logical next step, I think. Tees has been an incredible operation for a very, very long time, family-owned, values-driven. I visited one of their operations Monday this week, and I walked in the door, and within 15 seconds, I thought to myself, of course, this is the natural acquisition for Cargill, because on the wall is things like putting people first, doing the right thing, even if it economically doesn't make sense, you know. And I think Tees values those high integrity ideas, and Cargill does as well. And so it's been a really natural fit.
And yeah. What sort of money did that involve in the investment?
As a food safety leader, I wasn't involved in the capital or the investment side of things, but the capital that Cargill put into it, I'm sure, was, you know, fair and sizable. But we hope to grow it.
And where are the facilities based?
All across Eastern Australia. To that, they have some pretty sizable distribution centers and warehouses scattered up and down, you know, Eastern Australia. So you've got 14 locations, 3 feedlots, 6 beef processing plants, you know, cow into steaks and the initial cuts, 2 food manufacturing facilities, which is the value add, the further processing, whether it's grind or some other value added, you know, things we can do with the protein, a hide processing site, so just the skins, just the hide of the cattle, and a centralized distribution facility. One of the fascinating things about Tees and the Australian beef market is the length of their supply chains. They, you know, they've got, you know, over 100 130 days of shelf life on product. They ship all over the world. They supply, of course, Australia, New Zealand, Southeast Asia, Japan. They also supply to Europe, which is a fascinating, and they supply some specialty cuts to Brazil. The Brazilians like a certain culotte. You may have heard of a culotte cut, which is sort of the end cap of the rump. It's sort of a Brazilian delicacy. So Tees sends a lot of that cap, that culotte cut to Brazil. So they export more out of Australia than we do out of the U.S. Where I was brought in, I've been with Cargill for 9 years. The partnership went beyond my tenure at Cargill. So we've had various food safety leaders, including myself, come in and meet with the Tees team, review their processes and systems from a food safety side over the years. And we have incredible confidence in what they're doing from a food safety perspective, from a compliance perspective. They're the best.
And Tees headquarters has been at 8 Mile Plains in Brisbane. And what's Cargill's history, the company?
We're over 160 years old. Started in the Midwest of the United States. If you analyze the various demographics of the U.S. and the cultures of the U.S., the Midwest, Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin is incredibly humble, hardworking agriculture sector. Our start was basically storing grain for farmers and realized that while storing it, we could also make some money by trading the future value of that grain. Right. So wheat today is worth a different price than wheat will be in December. And getting some insights on what's going to happen to the future value of that allows us to either sell that wheat today or sell it in the future and make an extra buck. It doesn't hurt anybody. Those are the natural fluctuations of the market. And Cargill got its start basically trading the futures of certain food commodities like that. Yeah.
What commodities are you trading in now?
Just about everything. I mean, we've got a huge trading floor. If you were able to visit Cargill's headquarters, there's a huge trading floor in the middle of our headquarters building where we're trading everything from traditional food commodities like soybeans and wheat and corn to biodiesel and various precious metals and heavy metals. So anything where we feel like we have some insight into the market and where it's going to go, we'll try to trade because we're very good at it.
Sean Layton, Global Senior Vice President of Food Safety, Quality and Regulatory Affairs for Cargill, which now has 100% ownership of major meat processor Tees Australia.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. Michael has texted in and said, for a quite easy life, that's a unit in the city. You don't get easy in the country. That was about our earlier story about a couple who were dealing with their solar panels that had been smashed by hail. They had moved to the country in hopes for an easier life. It's definitely a lot quieter than living in a city, but I think a lot of us agree, Michael, that it's not always necessarily easier. I want to take you to a country town now because a tiny border town that sits between Queensland and New South Wales was hit with a series of pretty devastating blows, but a group of local women stepped up to help. After drought, COVID closures and then fire, it was more than just bricks and mortar that needed rebuilding in Mungindi. Landline's Courtney Wilson reports on the power of the people in the bush.
Mungindi is like many small country towns. But there is a big point of difference here. As well as being the only town in Australia situated on both sides of a state border, there is a special spirit here that makes Mungindi stand out. And at the centre of it is a little green coffee shop called Flock. For Mungindi, Flock came about just when it was needed most. A few years ago, Mungindi suffered a series of setbacks in relatively quick succession that had long-time locals like Anna Harrison really worried about the town's future.
People were having to let go of staff and families were leaving, and that's really hard because we just know in small communities you just can't get that retention back and it's hard to build a community back after that.
After 3 long years of drought came the COVID pandemic and border closures, which quite literally split this town in two. In 2019, the coffee shop closed. And then in 2020, a devastating fire wiped out several other shops in the main street, including the local supermarket.
And that's our livelihood in Mungindi gone. very sad to see.
It proved too much for some, and there were people and families who packed up and left. In a small community like this, that can be devastating.
You know, it's one less person on the canteen roster. It's a family short swim club. Yeah, it impacts everyone.
And I think the menu in the end was perfect for that. We pretty much know that...
For Anna Harrison, the bad luck that had befallen Mungindi was really concerning. She didn't want to see the town falter, and she wasn't alone with those worries. So Anna rallied the troops. Five women, all from Mungindi, or near enough, came together to find a way to bring a bit of spark back to the main drag.
We live here ourselves. We want a great town. We want a town to be proud of. And that doesn't happen by everyone sitting on their bottoms. Like, you've got to get in and do the hard work.
They decided their particular flavour of hard work would come in the form of a little coffee shop with a big goal to help bring Mungindi back from the brink.
I think there's lots of opportunities in a town like Mungindi.
Despite each having busy lives, with 13 children between them, as well as farms and other jobs, the women were fueled by a shared desire to give something back to their community. The five women played to their individual strengths, whether that was designing the menu, doing the logistical legwork, managing supplies, or dealing with staffing. In a border town 750 kilometres southeast of Brisbane with no local grocery shop, none of that was easy. But boy, was it appreciated.
Everyone comes here in the mornings, the Ambos, the local police, everyone comes here sort of for a catch-up in the morning. It's great.
It wasn't just the customers that benefited either. The ladies behind Flock were also finding unexpected fulfilment. Annette Hegney explains.
Filled my cup in so many ways. Being able to see the community and have somewhere to call in for a cuppa that wasn't the pub. There are limited sporting facilities available for anyone who isn't in primary school. So it was great to have a place that they could come to and enjoy the community and just make the most of being in town.
Fellow Flock founder, Sally Houston.
There's a group of oldies in town, and that used to just make my heart sing whenever they were sitting there having their coffees and chatting and catching up. Otherwise, they'd be just sitting at home on their own. So that was a really great thing that Flock brought to town.
Pitching in when times are tough is something people in the bush are known for, and these five women are all quick to point out they're certainly not unique. Including Emily Harris.
Plenty of women in Mungindi before us have done similar things, not the same, it mightn't be a cafe, but I do think it's always happened in rural communities and regional communities. There's always been a very deep understanding that you need community out here to keep these towns vibrant.
Late last year, the time came for the original Flock Five to pass on the baton. Luckily, another long-time local, Nikki Smith, stepped up.
Been a bit of a challenge, a lot more involved than really probably what I thought it was going to be. Probably 80 to 100 coffees a day. That's sort of average normally, yeah. So go through about 15 kilos of coffee beans a week.
It's not just people from Mungindi who've embraced the little green cafe either. Plenty of passers-by are also lured by the promise of a barista-made coffee to stop and spend a little extra time in town.
Best coffee ever.
For the creators of Flock, it's a joy to see another local at the helm of their pride and joy and a real sense of accomplishment for what they helped create.
The five of us are community-minded people, and I think you need that drive to do what we did.
I love the town of Mungindi. There's some really cool, interesting, fun people, and to get the opportunity to get to know them in a closer way is really... I feel really fortunate, all the people we got to know better through that.
Anna Harrison and Emily Harris ending that story from Courtney Wilson. Now, if you want to see more on that story, you definitely can, because it will be on Landline this Sunday. So tune in to see the full story on ABC TV from 12:30. But if you miss Landline on Sunday, you can definitely watch it back on iView at any time. Weather's up next.
So you're saying I'm stuck here?
Detective Sergeant Mackenzie Clark's back on the ABC. Ex-fiancé or just the challenge?
Impossible.
So you'd think. All new Return to Paradise starts Saturday, November 15 on ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
great to have your company on the Country Hour today, and it is time to check in on the weather. Harry Clark joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Harry.
Good afternoon, Megan.
So it's the rain is starting from today. There's a few storms about. Where are they in particular?
Yeah, so at the moment we do have the first thunderstorms of the day kicking off between Charleville and Longreach out through the central west there. Quite isolated at the moment. We do expect those thunderstorms to build further throughout that region, and it's not the only region. We do see that thunderstorm risk extend up into the northern goldfields, the Gulf Country, and indeed much of far north Queensland inland to the coast today as well. In terms of severe thunderstorms today, once again, mainly between Charleville and Longreach, bringing the risk of some damaging wind gusts and large hail if they do occur. I guess rainfall-wise, probably a little limited out of thunderstorms today. Not a huge amount of moisture returning just yet, but as we look forward to the next few days, that moisture does really build. Indeed, probably jumping ahead of myself a little bit, in the last 24 hours we did get some isolated moderate falls through parts of north and far north Queensland, up to 59 millimetres at Mount McConnell, which is just upstream of Burdekin Falls Dam. Also saw Fletcher Vale Road picking up 37 millimetres sort of well west of Townsville, and indeed the North Triple Coast we did see 93 millimetres at Mount Sophia just south of Gordon Vale in the 24 hours to 9 a.m. this morning. So that shift, focus shifting away from the north and far north into the interior today, and as I mentioned, tomorrow a real shift even further towards the south. The Maranoa, Warrego, Darling Downs and Granite Belt, southeast coast and Wide Bay. Likely to see a fair smattering of shower and thunderstorm activity. Once again, some of which may be severe through the Maranoa and Warrego, but the rainfall total is probably the more interesting part of that. We do see fairly widespread, sort of 15 to 30 millimetres possible through those areas, with some isolated high falls, even up to 50 millimetres possible tomorrow.
Yeah, so it looks like there's some big showers if you can get underneath them.
Yeah, that's correct, particularly tomorrow through the southeastern sort of quarter of the state. But looking further ahead, we get a real sort of plunge of tropical moisture over the weekend. So lots of humidity and moisture returning from the north, and it will be sort of linking up with a fairly extensive trough system. So virtually no corner of the state untouched by thunderstorms over the weekend, other than perhaps the east coast between around Rockhampton and Cooktown. But elsewhere, really quite sort of scattered shower and thunderstorm activity on Saturday and Sunday, and some decent moisture with it too, which means decent rainfall totals underneath them. So broadly looking at sort of 10 to 20 millimetres for many areas under thunderstorms, and indeed likely some higher totals as per normal, all the way from Mount Isa in the northwest down through the central west into the Maranoa and Warrego, the southeast corner of the state, the Wide Bay, and even as far west as the Channel Country. So that's Saturday. On Sunday, that system does start to shift eastwards more prominently, so it contracts out of the Channel Country and the sort of far southwest, but it gets even more moisture. So probably even, you know, like 20 to 30 millimetres on Sunday with showers and storms all the way from the southeast and band up through the central highlands and coalfields into the central west, the northern goldfields, northwest and Gulf Country once again. So not just thunderstorms, but probably some patchy rain areas in there as well on Sunday. Probably the peak day for that rainfall before it starts to shift east towards Monday.
Hmm. So how are these storms and these systems going to impact coastal waters?
Yeah, look, not too much, to be honest. We are seeing persistent sort of easterly flow, sort of 15 to 20 knots through much of northern Queensland and a bit more northerly through southern Queensland. We're really going to see those winds maintained over coming days, sort of, you know, fresh at times, 15 to 20 knots in places, but persistently from that sort of northeast to southeast direction. That's what's helping drive the moisture into these thunderstorms as we see them evolve over the next few days. So a good infeed of tropical moisture ahead. And I guess it's probably worth mentioning the risk of river level rises as well with some of those thunderstorms. It's very difficult to pin down any potential sort of flooding at this stage, given it will be convective and hit and miss in nature. But sort of the modelling is sort of focusing on that border rivers area as potentially seeing some localised river rises, as well as parts of the sort of Blonde Condamine system and even into central Queensland. So, you know, not looking at widespread major flooding or anything like that, but just be aware, if we do get those thunderstorms forming over the same place multiple days in a row, we could see some river level rises and some minor flooding in areas as a result of that.
And these systems, are temperatures likely to be sort of down with, you know, rainfall expected in a lot of parts of the state?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a seesaw in that regard. So I guess initially today we do have temperatures average or even slightly above average through much of the interior, and particularly the far west. So maximum temperatures are close to 40 degrees through our, or indeed slightly in excess of 40 degrees for our far west today, and sort of gradually dropping off the further east you head into the mid-30s through much of the remainder of the interior, and around 30 degrees for much of the east coast. As looked at tomorrow, similar pattern, sort of at or slightly below average in the east, particularly in the southeast, but remaining above average in the west. Really, as once we start getting towards that Sunday period where we start seeing those well below average temperatures develop through the interior. So parts of the northwest potentially, you know, even 10 to 12 degrees below average by Sunday in terms of maximum temperatures. That means highs in the high 20s for places like Mount Isa. And indeed, that sort of cool pattern really becomes quite extensive across the state, other than probably the far east from Monday too. So definitely once we get to Sunday onwards, a much cooler pattern in place under all that cloud and rainfall. Until we get there, a bit of a seesaw with mostly above average temperatures in the west and at or slightly below average in the east.
Harry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Harry Clark, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. ABC Gives, supporting OzHarvest to provide food and grocery relief for Australians in need. ABC Radio Queensland.
So how much can we raise in one day? We are finding out today with our ABC Gives Giveathon. Today we're raising money to support OzHarvest to keep their wheels turning and help people struggling to put food on the table. If you would like to donate, you can head online to abc.net.au/QLDGives. That is abc.net.au/QLDGives. You can also call 3708 1388. 3708 1388. Every dollar donated delivers two meals to someone in need. And I'll give you a tally on how much has been raised today at the end of the Country Hour. So expect that before 1 o'clock. But to my next story, barbed wire is a part of the landscape in rural Queensland. You see the fencing surrounding paddocks next to highways and down rural roads and even on properties themselves. And wildlife advocates have been arguing for a more friendly approach to fencing by replacing the top strand with plain instead of barbed wire. And the idea is that a lot of birds and even very little creatures, native creatures, could be saved from getting tangled in it. I'll take you to the far north now, because a recent proposal by the Cassowary Coast Regional Council would compel landholders to put in wildlife-friendly fencing, and that has been rejected by local graziers who say it's impractical and it won't work. Justine Douglas from the Kennedy Valley explains to Charlie McKillop why.
I guess most importantly, we have, as landowners, we have this legislation under the Biosecurity Act, which requires us to manage impacts of pests and diseases on our properties, and maintaining stock-proof fences is, I guess, critical to that. And fencing structures that don't suit your farming operation obviously going to lead to a higher risk of cattle escaping. And there's a lot of health and welfare issues and biosecurity and, I guess, community safety issues that come from that.
What happens? Why isn't it effective?
Obviously, I don't know how much, I suppose, you've been out with being the Country Hour reporter for a long time. You've seen cattle out in the paddock and they do rub on the top wire. If it's a barbed wire, they don't. If it's plain, they tend to rub on that wire. If you've got cattle in adjoining paddocks, they tend to talk to each other across the fence and they just rub on the top plane, and it does stretch. And then the integrity of your corner post is compromised, and then the stretching of your wire is not good, and then they tend to lean on the fence and next minute they're out. And a lot of the times if cattle get out, they know how to get out and they'll just keep getting out, and you've then got to deal with that animal. That's why I think the top barbed wire in a lot of situations is the only way to keep your cattle in.
But therein lies the rub. That's what wildlife advocates or supporters of this type of fencing are saying, that this would be a way of reducing the impact of your fencing on critically endangered species. Is that something that is in the back of your mind when you're making decisions around your land management at your place?
Well, it certainly is, and it's a little bit ironic that I'm actually talking to you, I guess, on behalf of my husband and I and of the Cassowary Post Grazing Association, which I'm part of, because we've installed it for the reasons that protecting wildlife is something that's core to us. We've worked in environmental fields ourselves, and we've always had a passion for wildlife, and we know the hot spots on our farm where, you know, there could be corridors where gliders and bats and so forth could get entrapped, and we've made attempts to make those places safe. So, yeah, like I said, a little bit ironic that I'm talking to you against having this wildlife-friendly fencing, but it's not actually against the fencing itself. It's against making it compulsory for all farmers in all locations to replace or install wildlife-friendly fencing, because it just isn't practical or feasible or safe in all situations.
Justine Douglas, talking to you about the practical implications of wildlife-friendly fencing on her farm in the Kennedy Valley in the Cassowary Coast region. What's your understanding of the genesis for that? Like, what did the council tell you about its decision to move down this path?
Well, this is a little bit, one of the reasons why our Grazies Association is a little bit upset is that there was no consultation at all with our association, and the council is aware of our association. We've had dealings with them over a number of other issues, but they didn't consult with us and give us a heads up as to this is what they were considering. I've heard on the grapevine that they've spoken with other interest groups, conservation groups, about this issue before developing the proposed wording for their new local laws, but they didn't consult with us. And I think as one of the biggest stakeholders and the people that are going to be impacted the most, you would have thought they would have consulted with us, and we could have explained to them some of the risks and issues associated with making it compulsory. I think a lot of our members would have taken the voluntary approach up, and they would have installed the wildlife-friendly fencing options where they could. But to propose it to be compulsory and not consult with us is, I guess, our biggest gripe. Like I said before, Charlie, we're not against the concept of wildlife-friendly fencing, and we're happy to install it where we can and where, I guess, locations that have been identified as important wildlife crossings or habitats. But to make it compulsory and not consult with us it's just not something that sits well with us.
And these risks that you are highlighting, how real are they?
Oh, they're real. I mean, if you don't have a fencing structure that suits your operation, you've got cattle out on the roads, they could be encroaching in someone else's property, there's biosecurity risks, spread of pests and diseases, the list goes on. And if you've got cattle out, it's very stressful. I mean, they could be out on the road, they could be in your neighbour's place, there's a lot of work goes into retrieving them. We all try to maintain our fences the best that we can, and in a lot of locations, the top barbed wire is the only way to keep your cattle in securely. And in some areas you can, like we have used the top plane in areas where it's suitable and we don't have a drama there, but a lot of the places you're going to need a top barbed wire to keep your cattle in my opinion.
What about the cost?
It's not cheaper. And in fact, if you're enrolling a spool of plane and you're doing it over a good distance, you're going to need a wire spinner. It's not that easy to unroll. I mean, it's not overly difficult, but you will need a different implement. And in regards to the barbless plane, we gave that a go in a couple of places, but it's a high tensile wire without the barb. They tend to rub on it. The wire unravels and it easily broken. So we've chosen not to go with that option.
Justine Douglas from Kennedy Springs in the Kennedy Valley between Cardwell and Tully, speaking to Charlie McKillop. Now, the Cassowary Coast Regional Council says the new regulations have not yet been introduced and it's a proposed change to a local law. Now, they've said that they have just completed a comprehensive community consultation for this, and they said graziers were given the opportunity to provide feedback, and they did get some written submissions from graziers, which they are currently reviewing all the submissions they have received. Now, to keep up to date on that one, I'm sure Charlie McKillop will be following that, so we'll have more for that one as it comes to light. Now, up next, from his introductory to horse racing through his father's blacksmithing to commentating the Roma Cup for more than 50 years, Peter Flynn looks back at his commentating career ahead of a special milestone this weekend.
The Ashes. And there's cricket
on. Rushes in and bowls a yorker and bowls him.
ABC Sports Summer of Cricket on your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
It is 10 minutes to one. The dust is set to rise in Roma over the weekend, kicked up by boots, high heels and horseshoes. The Roma Races in southern Queensland is celebrating its 60th year this Saturday. And someone who's been the voice behind the microphone for majority of those years is Peter Flynn. He reflects on his commentating career, which has now been calling races for more than 50 years.
We had a wonderful little neighbourhood where I lived with many kids in the same era, class at school and things like that. But I used to ride my bike down the street and call the race off the bike. My father was a blacksmith, actually, in the early days, prior to cars and things like that. Him and his brother had a blacksmith shop in Roma. But they used to do horseshoeing and work with racing plates and made their own and things like that. I found myself most Sunday mornings around horses, the owners and trainers bringing the horses in to get their racing plates taken off and their normal shoes put back on. So that was my first introduction to racing. I did pick up a job at the local radio station as an announcer, and obviously I had a sporting background, so I took the sports editor's role, and then the race calling came up just after that. A couple of years into that, I decided to have a go at it, and here I am. A guy here who was a teacher and was leaving town, and he was doing it. I remember the first race that he left me on my own with, and I think it was only a 3 or 4 horse race. But I actually, my legs were jelly. I think I'm not sure I got it right, but I don't think I messed it up. We had one meeting washed out, and I know I did miss one, so it's either 51 or 52, but I think it's more like 52 this year, yeah.
Gotcha. And what was the occasion that you missed one? What, you just had a better offer, did you, or what?
Many years back, I played a little bit of cricket, and I got picked in a representative cricket side, a South Queensland representative cricket side. I didn't get too many opportunities being from out in the bush, so I took that opportunity and went to that cricket game, which was actually played at Tweed Heads.
Fair enough. You weren't worried that the organisers of the races were going to see you as not a safe bet, so they were going to find somebody else?
I didn't think so at that stage, and it was very, very much in the infancy of my race calling. Yeah, this weekend we'll probably have 7 races with virtually capacity fields, so we'll have 12 runners in most of those 7 races.
And how do you prepare ahead of time?
I guess you're reasonably lucky in the fact that in the area, most of the trainers, you get to know their colours. Relatively, you've only got to, if you know that there's going to be 8 horses at off various trainers, so you know the colours of, you've probably only really got to learn 3 or 4 of those colours for the other horses that are new to the area. You know, that's the lucky part. But I know I used to go to St George and call the races, and a fair few horses came up from over the border at Moree and that, and it was very, right. You know, like a lot of new colours. So I, you know, that was a little bit harder. As I'm getting a little bit older, the memory fades a little bit. I put myself in a bit of a bubble at the races until the races are finished, and make sure I get it, well, as good as I can, put it that way. I'm not saying I'm the best race caller in the world or anything like that, but I try to get it so that I can paint a picture for the people who are at the race meeting or watching on TV.
It's been described as the Melbourne Cup of the West, the Rainbow Cup, but apart from just a phrase, is there a bit of truth to that? I mean, if someone has a winning horse in a smaller race around Queensland, they'll possibly be inclined to enter it in Roma as their major race?
We always race for very good prize money. We're racing for $127,000 at the weekend. It's the richest one-day regional race meeting in Queensland, and the club actually significantly adds value to the day of racing. Somewhere in the vicinity between $50,000 and $60,000 come out of the club coffers to put back into the industry for the day.
Wow, fantastic. So its reputation is well deserved.
We had a meeting last night, the club, and as a club we're very proud of where we've come from and where we're at the moment as far as the success of the Roma Turf Club goes.
How many more Roma races do you want to be calling? Obviously, you still enjoy it, but have you thought about that?
Not particularly. No, not at the moment. I did the a meeting at Chinchilla last Saturday. Enjoyed that. We'll continue to do the probably 20-odd meetings that I do every year, at least for next year anyway.
Fair enough. Find a job you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah, that's probably true, actually, as far as that goes, yeah.
That was Peter Flynn speaking with David Iliff. It's time to check in on the markets. First, the Blackall sales, where Sam Hart has the details.
Good afternoon. Numbers lifted to 3,800 at Blackall this week, with close to 2,400 prime cattle yarded. Quality remained high for prime grown steers and heifers, with averages lifting up to 20 cents, while prime cows remained firm to slightly cheaper, mainly due to condition. Heifers were still to sell. Local restockers paid up to 550.2 for good quality lightweight restocker steers, with averages lifting by 10 cents to 535. Steers 280-330 kilos sold to 544.2 to average 528. An extra feeder order saw a lift of 15 cents on heavy feeder steers, selling to 508.2 to average 487. Heavy ground steers to the processor saw good competitions from northern exporters and lifted by 20 cents to 468.2 to average 454. A very good run of preg-tested empty young prime heifers to the processor over 540 kilos sold to 442.2 to average 422. Medium cows sold to 396.2 to average 380, and good heavy prime cows made to 417.2 to average 395. This has been Sam Hart, the National Livestock Reporting Service.
And the weekly Warwick sheep sale with Errol Luck.
Supply of stock at Warwick reduced to 743 lambs and 554 grown sheep. The usual buyers attended, however, with the low numbers, not all could operate, which resulted in the heavy lambs and mutton seeing to easier trends of $5 to $14 a head. Lambs suited the wholesale and butcher trade sold at improved prices of 2 to 10, along with store lambs to restockers lifting by 15. Young lambs under 12 to restockers sold from 70 to 102. Young lambs in the 12 to 16 range to restockers sold from 131 to 149. And young lambs in the 20 to 24 range to the butcher trade sold from 146 to 249. Older lambs in the 20 to 22 range to the wholesale meat trade sold from 180 to 260. Lambs in the 22 to 26 range to processors sold from 232 to 276. The best heavy lambs stopping at 287. Hoggers to processors sold from 121 to 220. Lightweight crossbred and merino used to restockers sold from 105 to 130. And heavy use to processors sold from 128 to 177. Ram lambs to the butcher trade sold from 122 to 191. And ewes and lambs to restockers sold to 350 per unit. This has been Errol Luck, MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
ABC Gives. Tally update. ABC Radio Queensland.
So, how much can we raise in one day with ABC Gives Giveathon? And that is all going to Oz Harvest. So, the total as of coming up to 1 o'clock is $63,250 that has been raised so far. And every dollar donated delivers two meals to someone in need. Now, the goal is $100,000 for 200,000 meals. So the mission will continue through this afternoon. But news is coming up now because it is coming up to 1 o'clock.